Welcome to On Demand with Jenna Ellis. This is our AFR exclusive deep dive into the issues that you care about that are popping up in the news, in the world, in politics, and in culture. And so we bring on guests to do a once a week deep dive, more than we can do on the 1 hour of radio with all of the news of the day to discuss more just facets of one particular topic. And of course, this week, everyone is so focused on the economy and what is Trump doing with tariffs? Should we be concerned? Should we trust the plan? Does he have a good view? This has kind of been his perspective for at least 30 plus years, and he's finally implementing it. So why didn't he or did he try to implement this in the first term? And exactly where are we going? What should we think about all of this? And how is he spending his political capital? I find it very fascinating that along with the immigration and border patrol enforcement and all of this, instead of focusing at least right now on the midterms and some of those endorsements and maybe spending some political capital going after some of these members of Congress to codify his executive orders and hopefully impeach. And we know that judges won't be removed, but at least signal to them, well, hey, it's a possibility. Going after the judicial activists, at least in the forward-facing view of what the White House is doing, there's probably a lot more going on behind the scenes. He's really spending a lot of his political capital right now, this week, on his tariff plan. So joining me to discuss all of this and break down the political angles of all of this is my very dear friend, Mark Lotter, who is who is the co-host of Wake Up America on Newsmax, a show I've joined many, many times, and he's a former senior advisor for the Trump campaign, former press secretary to the vice president, has so much experience in Washington that he really does know what he's talking about, especially in Trump world. So good morning, Mark, and thanks so much for joining.
No, thanks for having me, Jenna. Great to talk to you again.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, kind of big picture here, what are you seeing, knowing as intimately as you do what goes on behind the scenes in Trump world? What is your view of where we are at with the tariff situation?
Well, I think it's twofold. Number one, I do think, you know, he has a fundamental belief, and you mentioned it in your intro, and you can go all the way back to the interviews in the mid-80s with Oprah and Phil Donahue, of all people, when he was talking about how America was getting ripped off by many of our allies and countries around the world. So he does have a fundamental view that if you are charging tariffs on our products, then we should treat you the same. And if you want to be zero tariff, he's all about free trade, but it's got to be reciprocal. And in too many cases, we're allowing foreign products to flood into our country while they're doing everything they can to keep our products out of their marketplaces. And then secondly, I do think that he is trying to bring about a significant change in certain areas, especially when it relates to China. Some areas with the European Union, Canada, and others, where he literally wants to see manufacturing brought back to America. So I think there's two different tracks that he's pursuing right now. One of them is a broader free trade, or at least reciprocal trade agreement. The other, he wants to see some things brought back to the United States for manufacturing, not only because it's good for American jobs, but also from a national security and food security standpoint.
Yeah. And, you know, this was a big emphasis, Mark, in his first term, as you and I well know. I mean, bringing back manufacturing to the United States, I mean, a huge reason for the USMCA replacing NAFTA was, you know, all about trade and, you know, and all about ensuring fairness and, you know, and renegotiating some of those trade agreements. And so we saw a huge emphasis on the Trade Advisor's office, then under Lighthizer. Now it's more Peter Navarro, which I think is also a fascinating facet to this. But where is this headed or how should we think about this? It's maybe the better question. Is this a continuation of what he was building up to in his first term? Is this a different type of strategy, or how should we try to understand what's going on?
Well, I think it's a continuation of the strategy to a certain extent. He had started this process, especially as it related to China, the European Union, Canada, Mexico, in his first term. Obviously, it was a much more limited and targeted approach, but it was designed to bring about specific changes. Obviously, we got the USMCA, and then you started to see there was talk about a free trade deal with the United Kingdom. The European Union was having serious problems. And so that continues. I think the broader tariffs is exactly what he's leading into. And of course, it helps when you're not shackled by the prospect of a re-election campaign 2, 3, 4 years later, which of course he does not have. So he is now free, obviously, to be able to do more of these very bold and direct moves. But the fact that you've already got now 70 countries who are calling, in some cases flying to America, saying, wait, we'll bring down our tariffs, or we'll go to zero if you'll go to zero. And ultimately, that's what he wants to see, where especially when it comes to places like Japan, Taiwan, Vietnam, other places in the Indo-Pacific that are trying to do this. The European Union's going to get there. They're just a little bit slower behind the eight ball, but they also know they cannot afford to be in a trade war with the United States.
Yeah, and that of course raises the question then, you know, where are we going from here? And is this more of the long-term strategy that a lot of economists are predicting, or do we expect to see some turnaround and maybe caving from, you know, whether it's the European Union, who's willing to match zero for zero, but then, you know, kind of changing their tune a little bit. But China does seem to be the outlier here that is suggesting, at least as of now, they're unwilling to move. But this has been kind of a cold war of sorts between the Trump administration, the Trump White House, and China going back to his first term. So how long do we anticipate this type of economic war going on? And I think the broader question to that, Mark Lauder, is how long do you think the people, and I'm talking more about, you know, the moderates, the Republicans, the conservatives that are willing to trust to a certain extent, but then maybe start to question. I mean, we know the MAGA loyalists will be there diehards, you know, till the bitter end, and they're not going to go anywhere. They'll never say anything bad about Trump, you know, fine. But for people who are, you know, genuinely trusting, but they're concerned, how long do you think that they'll give him before they want to see some results? And is someone like China, kind of knowing that, looking at his popularity right now, and that's actually going up after the tariffs, but they're sort of just playing the waiting game?
Well, the problem for China is that they don't have an economy that can play the waiting game very long. They may be very big, but they're also very thin. And so they're very fragile, and they're already struggling. And so they really can't afford too much of a disruption before it's really going to start to impact the Chinese government. As it relates to the American people, this is another area where I actually think Trump is playing this 4D chess very well, because if you look at some non-trade related factors, so oil has now dropped down below $60 a barrel to around $55, $60 a barrel, which basically means that maybe in 2 to 3 weeks, a month from now, we could be looking at gas closer to $2 a gallon rather than the current $3 and above. You also see the executive orders he signed in the Oval Office this week about coal mining. That's going to bring down energy prices. So I think a lot of regular mainstream Americans who don't sit there and listen to politics and watch the polls and see everything every day, they may glance at the stock market numbers occasionally, but they drive by the gasoline numbers every day. And on every street corner, they notice the price of gasoline. It also impacts the ability for them to spend on groceries or vacations or all those things. So we're going to see gas prices come down, which is going to buoy people, give them positive information. Also, it's going to impact their wallets positively. And so I think that's going to buy him a lot of time. Even if we do see some sort of a price fluctuation or price increase in some items because of the tariffs, people are going to be paying less at the gas station. You add on that here, I would predict, hopefully, by the August recess, you will have the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act expanded, spending to be cut, the one big, beautiful bill to be enacted, which is then going to provide tax relief. So he's doing a lot of other things that I think, say, at a retail human level, household level, people are going to notice, while on some of the ancillary items, 2 and 3 levels deep, you might see some other fluctuations. So I think this buys him time.
And that's the important ingredient here, is time. And so that would eliminate the possibility of, you know, some of these countries just waiting him out and seeing if the approval ratings go down. But, you know, we saw in the Biden administration, he just didn't even care about his approval rating. It was so abysmal and just kept going. And I hope that, unlike the first term, I see there is a difference that Trump just doesn't care as much about media or about what the public is saying about him and, you know, some of that political capital as he did in the first term. And I actually think that's a good thing. I think that he's seen that, you know, regardless of what policies he enacts or doesn't, obviously the fake news media is not going to give him a fair shake no matter what. And the people who trust him are going to stay loyal no matter what. And then there's, you know, some people in between. Like, I think, you know, you and I at this point can critique fairly what we do and don't like, or what we would and wouldn't like to see. But overall, you know, we're 100% more for conservative policy than anything else, and very much wanting him to win. So is this going to be multifaceted from a political standpoint to say, okay, once he starts seeing some of those things improve, then he'll move on kind of to something else and change, or try to change, the focus and the attention onto, say, Congress or the judicial activists, or, you know, some other facet of his policy?
Well, the judicial activism one's a little bit different, but I do think, you know, going back to the economy real quickly, you know, again, not only do I think gas prices, utility prices, and those things matter, and they will affect his approval rating, but think about it this way as well. When he talks about the 70 countries that are calling, the 70 countries that are wanting to strike trade deals, I can imagine that he's going to have 70 different news conferences where they're going to sign some sort of an agreement when they get one. And each time another country comes off the board as being, oh, we're going to go reciprocal but fair and low tariffs, or we're going to go zero tariffs, or we're going to strike a good deal for both sides, the market's going to be buoyed. The news coverage is going to be dominated by whatever country happens to be signing today. We're already seeing Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Australia wanting to make deals. So I think all of those things are going to set up to have a whole series of positive announcements, which the markets and others and economists will love going forward. As it comes to judicial activism, that's the tough one, because I think there's a little bit of give and take in terms of what Congress wants to do, what the judicial branch, meaning the Supreme Court, wants to do itself, and then what the White House wants to do. And so I think what you'll see, and I don't know, but what I would anticipate is that you will continue to have the White House keep the pressure on the judiciary. You'll still see Pam Bondi out there calling out activist judges. You're still going to see the Supreme Court in some cases, appeals courts in some cases, overturn a lot of these activist lefty judges who are making these rulings. But where we draw the lines, I think Congress does want to take a bite at the apple of reining in these judicial activists. And much like we would talk about sometimes, and I guess the best example I could use, think about the internet companies and the web companies. Whenever something happens, Congress threatens to regulate them, all of a sudden they find a way to self-regulate, so Congress doesn't have to get involved. I think Chief Justice Roberts, along with most of the conservatives on the court, would like to see themselves do this, as opposed to having to rely on Congress to do it, because you're getting into the difference between, you know, the three branches of government. And so if I'm Chief Justice Roberts, if I'm Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, I'm sitting there going, you know what, it's better if we take a stab at policing ourselves, and maybe we can find the right case where the majority can issue an opinion, which then becomes basically, I'll leave it to your expert opinion, judicial law, which reins in some of these out-of-control judges in their nationwide injunctions, rather than Congress and the White House, the other two co-equal branches of government, coming in and telling us how we will do our jobs.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more, Mark Lauder, with how ridiculous the judicial activism part of all of this is. And you know, there's so much hypocrisy, of course, from the leftist side, because they want to hold up and laud the Supreme Court and the judicial branch and every leftist judge whenever it's the outcome that they prefer. But then as soon as the Supreme Court does something that is correct in the rule of law, but it benefits the Trump administration, then suddenly, you know, these are terrible justices and, you know, look, obviously they're Republican appointed and, you know, blah, 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 blah. So there's not a standard for them of the judiciary other than to provide them the outcomes they prefer. And obviously for originalists, for conservatives, that's not the view of the judiciary. But the view of the judiciary is not to question or second guess or comment on policy decisions. And that's where I think even some in the not liberal wing, I wouldn't quite go as far as putting them into the conservative wing, so maybe the moderates of the court, like Chief Justice Roberts and even Amy Coney Barrett, are really stepping into that lane a little bit, and that's concerning. And so, you know, there does need to be a contemplation, and Congress has the best authority in this with the Judiciary Act to recontemplate a composition of particularly the lower courts in Article 3. And they have the discretion and the prerogative to do so. I mean, the Constitution is, as you and I well know, only says that there shall be one Supreme Court, not even a number of justices and all of that, but that's the only federal court that must exist. And then any other such courts, you know, as by law Congress may designate. And so they have wide discretion, but it seems like they're just really not using it. And so this gets to the overall question here, Mark, about Trump's political capital. Do you see him within, you know, even the next 6 months or so, which is a long time in Trump administration world, actually putting pressure on Congress to get their act together, literally an act of Congress, and help this runaway judiciary in a way that's even well beyond, you know, the outcomes that he prefers or just the next, you know, 3.5 years or his administration, but really into the future, because this will impact necessarily future Republican administrations?
Well, the one thing I would say is I cannot predict what they will do because I don't work there any longer. But what I have a feeling, knowing them the way I do, is that they will continue to keep the pressure on both branches. And it really, I ultimately believe this is going to come down to Chief Justice Roberts and the conservative majority self-policing for no other reason as well, is that if you're a member of Congress and you decide, even though you and I both agree that Congress does have the power to regulate the lower courts, not necessarily the Supreme Court, but who gets to decide whether they went too far? The courts themselves. And so it's a very slippery slope that if Congress comes in and says, thou shalt not do X, that you get obviously it'll go through the court system, but ultimately the Supreme Court will be the one to decide whether Congress and the White House went too far. So it's always easier for them to actually self-police. And so I think Congress and the White House keeping the pressure on will then prompt ultimately the majority. And you've already seen it. I know Justice Thomas, and you'll know it better than I will, so I'll trust you. But I know Justice Thomas, I think it was Justice Alito, has also written in some concurring opinions and some dissents, some very stern warnings to lower courts that if they keep doing what they're doing, that they're going to force the court itself to come in and start to self-regulate. That's probably the best bet. I'm not going to name names, but I remember a few years ago we were having a very similar discussion. I was talking to one of the top legal judicial minds in the Senate about this very issue. And I basically said, well, why doesn't Congress come in and just say, hey, district courts, circuit courts, your rulings are no longer valid outside of your jurisdiction? Seems like a fairly common sense idea, right? Stops nationwide injunction. And this very wise elder statesman and judicial expert told me that, well, you run the risk then of what happens when mom sues in Texas, sues McDonald's for hot coffee, despite the fact that's a stupid lawsuit, but you'll get the example. And McDonald's is headquartered in Illinois. Well, the judge in Texas can't rule then. If they rule, does that hold McDonald's in Illinois responsible? You run that risk. You also run the risk of every court case that involves the federal government on either side running through Washington, D.C., whether it's the district courts, the courts of appeals, ultimately the Supreme Court, because even if you are a low court judge in Washington, D.C., your district includes Washington, D.C., and you can order them not to do something, you just made the D.C. district courts, circuit courts, then ultimately the Supreme Court, the ultimate super courts, because that's where every case goes. And we have such a deficit of conservative, fair-minded judges in D.C., it actually hurts conservatives, at least in the near term.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it also encourages forum shopping. It was interesting to see the Supreme Court actually admonish the plaintiffs in this Trende Aragua case that, you know, now this week the Supreme Court decided to say, you know, yes, Trump can actually enforce his immigration policy, but they deserve due process somehow. That was a little ridiculous, but basically saying this should have been brought out of Texas instead of D.C. Well, why wasn't it brought out of Texas? Well, obviously, we all know a Texas judge would have likely been more favorable to the Trump administration at the outset. So they forum shop and they bring it in D.C. where they know that they will likely get an outcome favorable to their client and put the case on a posture trajectory that will be ultimately favorable to their outcome, which thankfully wasn't overall at the Supreme Court. But we still had to wait for that ultimate decision, which is weeks later. And that often doesn't even happen, that it's only a few weeks later. But to your point, Mark, it's so mind-boggling why Republicans, when we do have the trifecta, I mean, yes, there are issues with the Senate, they're not doing as much as they could under their authority and their limited powers in Article 1 to put the judiciary into its proper scope and context, when clearly they have abused their jurisdiction, they've abused their subject matter, they've abused judicial review, and this goes all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And if we are truly conservatives, and if we are truly wanting to have our vote count and say, yes, I voted for this, and have this, the policy, be able to be enacted and implemented without being thwarted by these basically oligarchs and tyrants in black robes, then Congress is going to have to act, because lawsuits are only as good as a good judge. And so you can't curb the judiciary just through good precedent. You have to actually do it at its source, which also includes funding. I mean, that's a huge part of where Congress can control a lot. If they just simply said, you know what, all of these circuits, like the Ninth Circuit, for example, they're so ridiculous, we're going to break that into two, and we're not going to fund all of this stuff, or we're going to revisit the composition of the federal courts and eliminate a lot of these benches and these seats that have gone completely outside the scope of Article 3. I mean, there are a lot of different ways that Congress could contemplate this. Are you hearing that they're even considering this? Because, you know, the latest from Congress so far, and what I'm seeing on my social media feed this week, is that they're all, you know, into this bipartisan nonsense with Anna Paulina Luna here out of Florida, you know, talking about proxy voting. And I'm thinking, nobody cares. We want you to show up, do your job, and actually codify some of this so that it's not just for the Trump administration, it's for the future of the country. And they're sitting there fighting the dumbest battles.
Well, I do think that there is work going on. I know they've had some hearings on it. A few of the committees have had hearings, I think, both in the House and the Senate on the judiciary, on these out-of-control leftist judges. And again, I'm going to just kind of make a leap of assumption here. I do think right now, especially knowing you're probably not going to get 60 votes out of the Senate, is what they're trying to do is put the pressure on the Chief Justice, on the court to police itself, or risk the wrath of Congress coming in and doing something. Because to your point, funding can be done through reconciliation. It can be done without the 60-vote Senate threshold. So again, by them holding these hearings, by a few key members talking very publicly about what next steps should be taken, may not be this year, it may not be this reconciliation bill, but I think they are setting the stage and sending a very stern warning to the Article 3 branch that says, if you don't deal with this, we will. And so then it's going to be a question really for Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Thomas Alito, to go, where are we going to go with this? What's the right case? And how do we do this so we can get Congress and the White House off our back, but maintain our judicial independence?
Yeah, and Well said. And, you know, when you go back to the fact that, yes, unfortunately, we don't have a filibuster-proof majority of conservatives in the Senate. Last question for you, Mark Lauder, and we could spend so much more time, you know, talking about all of these things, but this is why, you know, the deep dive is great, even for what always feels like, you know, the shortest half hour we have. But where are we positioning for the midterms? Do you see the current posture of America kind of thwarting what has been historical precedent of losing seats in the same party as the current White House incumbent, and maybe Republicans actually gaining seats in the Senate in 2026? Or is it maybe too early to tell?
Well, I think in the Senate, it looks good right now. And I'll tell you, though, you know, it's April of year one. If we went back to April of 2020, you know, Joe Biden was sitting pretty at that point. But, you know, he had the botched Afghanistan withdrawal that was in August, you know, and so that all started to change the narrative. So things can change very quickly. I would tell you right now, I see us adding seats in the Senate, primarily in Georgia. I think there's a decent chance in Michigan. Those are probably the top two opportunities for pickups. There are some others out there. I think it's going to take the right candidate and the right set of factors breaking nationally, but definitely I think there's some options out there where we can pick up some of those seats. House is going to be more difficult. It's already closely divided, obviously, because of that outcome in Wisconsin. You're going to get activist liberal Supreme Court that's going to redraw those congressional maps and cost Republicans two seats. So that even takes a small majority and makes it even smaller, at least going into it by the map. But I do think they'll be able to add some certain seats. I think it's all going to be about proof in the pudding. You know, if the border is secure, if gas prices are low, if the tariffs have all worked their way through, we start to see investment in America, grocery prices are going down, the war in the Middle East and or in Europe is contained, then I think Republicans are sitting poised. The other thing I think we cannot underestimate is that our opposition still has no idea why they lost. Mm-hmm. And they have no message. Right now they can chant, they can scream. They've shown that they can rhyme. And that's literally all that they have shown. They're not
about
workers.
They have Jasmine Crockett. Come on. Like, isn't she like the new face of the Democrat Party? That's got to be a winning message.
That's got to be a winning message. I think it was Senator Kennedy yesterday. He said, thank you. You know, it's because of AOC that they have to have explanations on shampoo bottles. But eventually they will come up with a message. But so far, they have not been able to do so. They're digging into Resistance 2.0 and their rallies and their anger. I'm not sure if that's enough to get them across the finish line.
Yeah, and I think a lot will depend on who is in the primaries as well on the Republican side. And I think we've seen that, frankly, some of those primary endorsements from Trump have been disappointing or maybe not the best overall conservative. And then, you know, he kind of has to push them across the finish line or it's a little too close for comfort. I mean, even here in my home state of Florida, the gentleman running for the seat for Florida 6th, it was not the best Republican that the party could have put up. And it was a much, much narrower race, even though he eventually won the congressional seat that was vacated by Michael Waltz. This was a district that Trump had won in 2024 by 30 points. And so, you know, do you think the Trump world is maybe learning its lesson a little bit in terms of choosing better primary candidates?
Well, the difficult thing with primaries is, number one, especially in special elections, I don't put too much weight in those because it's easy to motivate the opposition, the liberals, with anger. That's all you need. Be angry, come out and vote. It's a lot more difficult, and Republicans have traditionally not performed well in special elections, so there's always that. But going into the primary process, you know, the biggest challenge I think we face on the conservative side is that not all districts are created equal. They're not all MAGA. They're not all Rhino. There's some in between. And to win a seat in, say, Maine takes a different kind of Republican than to win one in Texas or in parts of Florida. And I don't think we can put litmus tests on either kind we've got to necessarily pick the right person to win in that district. Because even if I only get that person's vote 90% of the time or 85% of the time, it beats the 0% of the time if the radical left gets in there. And so I think too many times in politics, especially those of us who do it on a daily basis, we believe that because someone won nationally or because someone or some movement is popular at the moment, that every person in that needs to be the exact same. I mean, I'll go back to the Tea Party in the early, you know, 2010s and right after the Obama elections. You know, those Tea Party candidates in, say, New Hampshire and in Arizona and other places, they might have looked great, but they weren't the right people for those districts, and we lost seats we could have won, where maybe a more moderate Republican, someone who better fit that demographic, was the right candidate. And I'm sure there are times, obviously the exact opposite is true as well. You need someone who's more dye-in-the-wool, red-blooded MAGA, depending on the district. So I think that's where candidate selection has to be. And we have to trust that the folks that can win in the general, make sure the people who can win in the general election are the ones who get through in the primaries.
Well, really interesting and wise commentary from you, Mark Lauder. And you've definitely been around the rodeo a time or two with all of these concerns and, you know, of course, with the first Trump administration into the second. So last question before I let you go. What is your prediction otherwise in terms of Trump's overall popularity? Do you think that he'll continue to see that rise, or do you think that that'll just really depend on kind of the outcome of the short term of the economic push?
Well, I think the economy is definitely going to be a driver in that. I think the border is going to buy him a lot of popularity, but it's going to buy you popularity on the right and in the right center. I think the middle and even the soft left is going to go totally off the economy. And when you start to see gas prices go down, when you start to see other prices go down, I think you'll see his popularity increase. If we start to see some sort of, you know, broader inflation, price increases, and if the gas prices don't go down, then I think you'll see a dip. But I also don't think that that's going to be enough to change his mind right now, because I think he's playing the long game, where we're seeing manufacturing coming back, or at least leaving China and going to other Asian allies where we have better access and back home here in America. And that takes time. That takes years to build a factory, to retool a factory, to hire these workers. But I think in the long term, it'll be the right answer.
All right. Well, Mark Lauder, thanks so much for joining, co-host of Wake Up America on Newsmax and former special assistant to President Trump and also my colleague on the Trump campaign. And so you can follow him on X at Mark, M-A-R-C, underscore Lauder, Mark underscore Lauder on X. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. And you can suggest topics and guests that you want to hear from, and issues that you want to talk about when we do these deep dives weekly. And make sure that you are listening each and every morning to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio from 7 to 8 Central Time, 8 to 9 Eastern. And I will see you next week for more here on Demand.